Today I'm talking to Sarah Koplik about her new book that's just been published, A Political and Economic History of the Jews of Afghanistan. Welcome.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you for having me here today.
Well, the last time we did an interview was at United World College when you were there. So we know already that you sort of like to do things differently and sort of out of the norm. Tell me about what you got out of that experience of leaving school in Albuquerque and going off to United World College.
Well, Susan, about 27 years ago, you interviewed me. And I went to United World College in Las Vegas, New Mexico, which I did 2 years there for senior year of high school and freshman year of college. And it was an environment where there are about 200 students from 80 countries all over the world. And that certainly expanded my worldview. I learned so much from my peers about where they live and how life is different for them in different places. And that experience has continued with me for the rest of my life, until this very day.
I had a feeling that was true. We should say that that's in Las Vegas, New Mexico.
Yes,
so
yes.
There's really no reason that it should be this expanding experience, except that it brings students from so far.
Right.
And is that why you wanted to do it? I mean, leaving high school your senior year.
The beginning of my senior year.
Yeah, you know, that's most people want to be with their friends then.
Right. Well, I was fine in Albuquerque. I was doing very well. But I wanted to have an experience of meeting young people from all over the world. And that is exactly what happened. It really expanded my sense of what's out there. I became much more outgoing as a result, much more social. I was more of an introvert before.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned about all kinds of differences. And that, I think, is transmitted even today. Even to my book today, I would have friends who are from the Muslim world, and we'd compare the difference between the Shahada and the Shema. And that was fascinating for me, and it really opened things up.
And after that, you went to Bryn Mawr College, and I think you majored in...
In history.
Okay.
In Middle, it was like a Middle East, but it was basically history.
Okay. And you traveled during that time too, right?
A little bit. And then afterwards.
Okay.
Yes, I was a Wallenberg Scholar at Hebrew University for a year.
Mm.
And then I went on to the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London, where I received a master's degree in Central Asian Studies and a doctorate in Middle Eastern history.
And so does this book come from the work that you started then?
Absolutely. This is my dissertation. It's based on European archives. Absolutely.
Okay. Is this your first book?
It is. It is very much so. It's my first book, yes. I have a child and a book. It feels like, you know, two birthing processes, as it were.
So that must be exciting. How long have you been working on it?
Well, I worked on it for 7 years, and then I had a break of about 12, 13 years where I didn't work on it. And then last year, I started to really try to get it published.
Okay. And we're talking about a political and economic history of the Jews of Afghanistan. Clearly, this is an important time to do work about in Afghanistan, which it wasn't when you started it, probably.
Oh, it was very esoteric. In fact, in August of 2001, when I was doing my research, I was told why was I working in such an esoteric, strange subject, and that I should do something more valuable, like finance. Oh. And then, of course, 1 month later, all of a sudden, my subject wasn't so esoteric mm-hmm. anymore.
So you must have felt that you really wanted to get this in print.
Thought it was important, especially when people started to borrow from it. Then I knew I had better get it published.
Oh, really? Is that
yes.
what? Oh,
yes, yes.
I see. Okay, good. Okay, well, as I was reading it, I was trying to think of how we could characterize this to the listening audience. Mm-hmm. And then I got to your conclusion, and you just did it beautifully about the importance of the book and why we need it now. So before we even go any further, I wanted to ask you to read from part of the conclusion.
The history of the Jewish community of Afghanistan is almost a microhistory, describing the experiences of a very small group. However, by concentrating on these details, a great deal of clarity regarding larger trends emerges. Their history may be seen as a microcosm of the convulsions of the 20th century. The community's experiences also foreshadow the larger traumas of the emerging Afghan nation, of great suffering and dispersal. This work links Jewish history to the larger currents surrounding it through archival research. Generally, the Jewish and Muslim histories of Afghanistan have been recorded separately. In Judaic studies, a cursory, often inaccurate examination of larger trends is presented, while descriptions of the majority history generally ignore minority experience. While some works have been translated into English, the overwhelming history of the Jews of Afghanistan is written in Hebrew. This work represents the most significant contribution made outside of Israel. It begins to supplement the history of minorities in Afghanistan, and it is hoped that in future research, those with stronger language skills will be able to uncover sources in Dari, Pashtun, and Russian, filling in details and providing a more complete explanations. The demise of the Afghani Jewish community is a case study of the failure of Afghanistan to embrace the talents of its non-Islamic minorities. A microcosm of future failures can be viewed within this limited history. Perhaps one source of these lost opportunities may be traced as far back as the reign of Abdulrahman Khan in the late 19th century. When this emir chose to eschew economic development to retain more political autonomy and destroy traditional patterns of coexistence and tolerances, he passed on a bitter legacy. These policies were reinforced by other leaders and continued to have detrimental effects throughout the 20th century. While later witnessed on a mass scale, even in the 1930s and 40s, these patterns were apparent in miniature through the history of the Jewish community. In many ways, Afghanistan still faces challenges surrounding this legacy, as questions of political autonomy, economic development, tolerance for ethnic minorities, and the last largest group of those with protected yet second-class status, women, are far from being resolved.
Okay, that is one word that I was really glad that you brought in at the end, of course, is women. But before we go into that, let's talk a little bit about what you used as sources, because at one point you say that you weren't able to use Russian sources because you don't read Russian. And to put this together, you're going from letters, private letters, and public letters, but not necessarily official sources.
It's stuff you uncovered. It's actually the archival record. I relied upon archives in Western Europe and in the United States and in Israel. No, so it's based primarily on archival research, as well as some interviews, but mostly national archives and Jewish archives.
Okay, so that became clear, I think. Although you refer to other work and other work that people do, but you're basing what you're thinking about is based on these archives, but also some interesting interviews. There was one person that you found in Tucson. Who was very old. So tell a little bit about that.
So good. I interviewed a prominent historian of Afghanistan. His name is Ludwig Adamek. And he was actually married to a woman who is from one of the royal families of Afghanistan, Amanullah's family. And so early in my research, I traveled to Tucson to interview him as one of the preeminent historians of Afghanistan, and I was able to meet his wife and his stepchildren, who were also engaged in research and helped me with sources in Dari and letters that I wouldn't have had access to otherwise.
Then you also found some people in Israel, I think, who thought back, who remembered what happened during their childhood and told you stories about that. So that must have been wonderful.
That was really exciting to do. I interviewed Jews who came from Afghanistan to Israel in the 1930s and 40s. And so they were recounting stories of their youth and childhood, what it was, you know, crossing. One woman was undocumented, crossed illegally into what was then the British Mandate of Palestine. She was arrested and put in jail for a year and then allowed to stay. Mm. Other people came later in the 1950s. And even one of my students at the University of New Mexico, her family also came from Afghanistan.
How neat.
So that was quite serendipitous. In fact, her great uncle and aunt's picture is actually on the cover of the book. So that was really special to me.
Yeah, that's nice. What made you pick Afghanistan? Was it because of its importance, in its geopolitical importance?
Actually, no. Well, I started out looking at a Bukharan, Central Asian Jewish women's experience, and I was looking at their practices, their religiosity levels in the Soviet Union, and then immigrating to Israel and how that shifted. And I wanted to continue with that work. But living in London, as I did, there was next to nothing in the field. But, of course, the British were very interested in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So there's a great deal of information about Afghanistan. And hidden kind of inside the London Metropolitan Archives and in some dusty files was this extraordinary story of what happened to the Jews of Afghanistan in the 1930s and 40s that had never been published, certainly not in English and alluded to in Hebrew. And I thought it was an extraordinary account, and I wanted to study it.
I was struck by when you talked about the British going into Afghanistan, and of course they, when we went into Afghanistan, they were an army that helped us and went with us, but I didn't realize that it had been so important to them at the end of their empire when they were trying to gather together forces and gather together power and keep some of their power. And as we went into the world wars, I had sort of forgotten about that.
Afghanistan was a gateway to India. And as such, and it was a buffer between the Russian Empire and then the Soviet Union and the British Empire. And so in that respect, it's a liminal place where really these two world powers were meeting. And that's why it was very important to the British and also very important to the Russians and later Soviets as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm. And we were sort of Johnny-come-latelys.
Indeed. Indeed. For different reasons. Yes, yes, exactly.
Well, we started a little bit to talk about women and women of in the early society and well into the society they played a very limited role because they were very protected. Although there's some interesting stories that you tell about some terrible things that happened to women that seem to have caused repercussions.
Well, let me step back a little bit and explain that Jewish women in Afghanistan had a very limited world, that they were mostly confined to their households, which were multi-generational, inside the Jewish quarter of main cities, Herat and Kabul, basically. And the men in this community would go out for long periods of time on trading journeys to northern Afghanistan or to many of the surrounding nations. And so women were left really to their own devices for long periods of time, which is quite unusual. Mm-hmm. In that respect, they probably had more autonomy than they would have otherwise. But as far as their experience with the outside, with the Muslim society, they were very isolated. They would have to wear full burqas also going outside of the Jewish quarter, but they were a different color. And so Jewish women were immediately recognizable. Mm-hmm. And so that could be dangerous in times of social strife.
And you said that they had to keep their daughters from going to school sometimes.
Sometimes.
Because they might get kidnapped.
For fear of that, yes. There's great fear of being kidnapped and forcibly converted to Islam. That was absolutely true in the 1950s in Herat. There was an account from the 50s in Kabul of a young woman who, a teenager, 13-year-old, who was forcibly converted to Islam. And what's remarkable about this story is that she was able to return to her parents and that she wasn't forced to marry her kidnapper. Mm-hmm. And that shows that there had been a change in the community because for decades before that, that would have been impossible. But the father was able to appeal to the king of Afghanistan, Muhammad Zahir Shah. And then he also wrote letters to the outside world. And in fact, one of the letters arrived in London, which is how I read it in the archives, asking for help. And he was able to solicit enough help to save his daughter.
So do you think there's more of a story there that you want to go back to?
I mean,
not that particular story, but women.
Women in the Jewish community of Afghanistan, it's hard to find. It is based on interviewing people, because I was able to find out what happened to that young woman by interviewing one of her classmates who said that, you know, she was safe. She eventually made it to Israel. She married. Her husband died. She married again. You know, she had a regular life. But I also hope that the Afghanistani Jewish community all over the world is now able to take their history and celebrate it and discover more about their history.
So you want more people doing this work?
I hope so. I mean, they're yes, yes, absolutely. They, interestingly enough, even though there's only one Jewish man left in Afghanistan, the worldwide community, the diaspora community or the Afghanistani Jews outside of Afghanistan who live in New York and who live in Israel have been trying to preserve ancient synagogues and cemeteries.
Oh, good.
And working very hard to do that very quietly.
So that was one of my questions, was one of the chapters or parts of your book is The Last Jew in Kabul. Mm-hmm. And so tell the story of that.
So there's one poor man who lives in Kabul by himself. There used to be two, and they squabbled a lot and got themselves thrown into jail under the Taliban, and their Torah was taken by the Taliban. And now there's just one man left, and his family's in Israel, and they really don't understand why he's not there with them. He used to have a little restaurant, I believe, according to news accounts. But that's it. As far as the ancient community is gone. And what's interesting about this community is that 1,000 years ago, it was extremely vibrant, flourishing community, until the Mongols really came. And then everything was destroyed. And we don't hear again from the community for about 500 years until the middle of the 1800s. And then it starts to come back on the edges of countries, on the edge of the Persian world, on the edge of the Persian Empire, on the edge of Persia, on the edge of Bukhara, Central Asia, on the edge of India. And then they make their way to Afghanistan.
Well, you really give a picture of what the community was by going so far and talk about what they had developed, especially since they were so isolated that they kind of didn't, whatever was developed was their own because they just didn't even know what was going on sometimes in other parts of the world. And I was interested that when they started going, when Israel finally was founded, and they started having the possibility of going into Israel and eventually were able to do that. They were expecting to find that kind of community, I think, that had been theirs in Afghanistan. And it wasn't there because it couldn't be. It just was an interesting sort of dilemma.
Right. Well, I mean, they greeted the establishment of the State of Israel with sort of messianic expectation that there was boundless joy. They couldn't believe that this had happened. And so they wrote letters to the government of Israel in just with this extraordinary happiness. And they really didn't get a response. And so the next letters that you see are much more disappointed and calling upon the leadership to listen to them, to help them. Of course, there's a lot more going on than this tiny community of 5,000 souls. And there were survivors of the Holocaust were a far higher priority, as well as Jews in Iraq and Yemen, who were under much worse conditions. Morocco, Egypt, where they were also put in some kind of like camp settings, unfortunately, and subject to a great deal of violence and discrimination at the beginning of the State of Israel. Afghanistan, the Jewish community was protected by the king. King Muhammad Zahir Shah was very concerned with their well-being. And so the policies that had been enacted earlier under his uncle, under his father, were not enforced anymore. And so there was an amount of protection that the community had in the early 1950s that they didn't have previously.
Mm-hmm. Those policies were that they had to wear different clothes?
That's very old. That's old in Islam. The Ahle Dhimma. For those who are second-class protected peoples who are non-Muslim, they were not allowed to, for example, in Bukhara, wear a belt or ride on a horse. They could only ride on a donkey. They had to be easily recognizable. There are a series of restrictions like that. In Iran, some of the strongest restrictions were a Muslim wouldn't touch something that a Jew had touched.
Uh-huh.
So, or wouldn't touch directly. For example, if you're going to pay for a taxi, if you're a Jewish person, you can't hand the money directly to the taxi driver. You'd have to put it down first.
Oh.
And so there all these restrictions, yes, there are still the traditional restrictions in place. However, Muhammad Zahir Shah rolled back some of the economic nationalism restrictions that his father and uncle had implemented, whereby Jews weren't allowed to engage in trade. They weren't allowed to live in the northern tier of the country. They were rounded up and placed into old caravanserais, compounds, where they weren't allowed to work. So they died from the conditions, but they weren't outright killed. So that was the prelude to wanting to leave the country. And for two decades before, they would flee across the border illegally into Iran, into India.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the establishment of India and Pakistan, it became impossible to go to India via Pakistan because of partition, of course. So then they went through Iran. And I think it's also interesting, I wanted to talk for a moment about how the community was established in 1839, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1839, in the city of Mashhad in northeastern Iran, the entire Jewish community was forcibly converted to Islam in an event called Al-Adad, God Gave. And much of the community remained as crypto-Jews pretending that they were Muslim. And some of the community started to flee into the northern desert, into the Turkmen areas. And that's how the modern community of Afghanistan, the Jewish community, was established. They first settled in Herat and then later into Kabul.
Mm-hmm.
But as a result of widespread persecution inside Persia.
And we should say that crypto Jew is someone who is hidden.
A secret Jew.
A secret, yes. We've talked about that with some of the work that Carrie Hertz did.
Sure, absolutely.
In New Mexico. And that lasted for a long time, that they had to sort of, everything was undercover.
Over 100 years. Mm-hmm. In fact, they're the only crypto-Jewish community in the world that was able to maintain Jewish practice because of the way that Shia Muslim society is structured. So what this crypto-Jewish community would do is they would, when they would go to pray, they would put an old woman sitting in front of the room. And so no Muslim man would enter the part of the home where there was a woman sitting.
Oh, so they could, so they that would, no one would
them.
Burst in.
Right. So the strict separation of the sexes in Shia Islam in northeastern Iran particularly was able to protect the Jewish community who did not have those kind of strict segregation by sex.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was used strategically. So the old woman would be sitting outside and then a religious service would happen inside of that room. And so because of this cultural difference, the community was able to maintain Jewish practice. And then after over 100 years, when they left Mashhad, they went to Tehran and then on to Israel, then they reverted to an open practice of Judaism.
Okay. Let's talk about the economic, sort of what happened in Afghanistan as far as economy goes, because it's really interesting the way it seemed to me that the Jewish people kept sort of getting things going and making the economy work, and then they'd be pulled back and the economy would go down again.
It was, in the book, I concentrate really on the Jewish perspective, but there were lots of other ethnicities that were also involved in Afghanistan's economy. But of course, it's a developing country. So one of the most important things that we studied in, that I looked in the book was learning about the caracal trade, which is a trade in Persian lamb's wool, which is a dark, curly wool that in the 1950s, there were coats that were made of Persian lambs. Well, it was very fashionable. So when the communists rose in Central Asia and Stalin's policies began to impact traditional shepherds in Turkmen and what became Turkmenistan and what became Uzbekistan, then those people started to flee into Afghanistan. So Turkmen shepherds arrived with their hundreds and thousands of sheep, of heads of sheep, in these enormous flocks. And coming into Afghanistan, they provided Afghanistan with the number one source of foreign earnings, mm-hmm. hard currency. But unfortunately, also in this time, there was the beginning of economic nationalism started, meaning that the leadership of the country, Pashtun royalty, Pashtun nobles, wanted to have their cut of the economy. But instead what happened was the policies that they enacted were so detrimental that the economy just collapsed as a result of restricting traders, making sure that only one ethnicity was able to engage in this trade, and it was very tightly controlled. And the shepherds weren't able to travel, that they couldn't get the best rate for their sheep, all these sorts of issues. And it impacted many, many peoples. But most of those peoples remain silent. We don't hear their voices because they didn't have connections with the outside world.
Yeah, and because they were afraid.
Well, they may not have had access to being able to send a letter,
mm-hmm.
and because even that was restricted. So letters would be smuggled out of the country.
Yeah. Do you know anything about when they got to Israel and whether they had better lives? I mean, I would assume they did, but do you know anything about what their lives became? There were so many difficulties, and they were so in such poor health, and just because of famine and lack of medical care and mm-hmm. lack of good places to live and things like that, that I really wanted life to get better for them, but I'm not sure if it did.
Oh, no. Very much so. More stable, able to engage in commerce, able to be part of society. Absolutely. Very different. Full members of society. The Afghan Jewish community is tiny, still tiny. It's about 10,000 people worldwide. Mm. Interestingly enough, they were not in the ma'abarot, the absorption centers, the refugee camps. They were not in Israeli refugee camps, as most other Sephardi and Mizrahi Jewish people, Jews of the Middle East and the Muslim world, North Africa, were.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, family members took them in because there had been a trickle of immigration since the early 20th century, especially into the Bukharan quarter in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And so right away, they had to step up because they weren't in these ma'abarot, in these camps. They were able immediately to be in either cities or moshavs or kibbutzes or wherever, but they weren't. Yeah, that made life easier for them. And some still today are engaged in the colored gem trade. I interviewed one person on the diamond exchange, lots of business people. So their business skills certainly stood them in good stead, as well as their incredible multilingualism. Mm-hmm. I mean, an astonishing number of languages that certainly men could speak. Women might be able to speak one or two languages, unfortunately, and men could probably speak four or five.
Oh, okay. That was going to be my next question. This book is in English. Mm-hmm. Are there any plans to translate it, or do you not have to because everyone can read English?
Oh, no, they can't these days. No. If I would hope to be able to find a publisher to publish the book in Hebrew. That would be wonderful. Hopefully, I'll have a French and Italian edition. But most of the community lives in Israel. So if there could be a Hebrew translation, I think that would certainly serve the descendants of the Jews of Afghanistan well.
So what you wanted to do with this is you wanted to make a record in it and save some of the memories that are fading, that we're losing. But what else do you want people to get out of it who read it?
That's a good question. As I was doing my work, I got the most wonderful compliment. And he told me, Sarah, you weren't there, but you were able to describe it so well. How did you get all those details right? And that's because that's what historians do.
Mm-hmm.
That's what our work is that we're able to very carefully going through archives, interviewing people, getting a sense of the larger history, to recreate at least a part of what happened in our past. And I know that this is a micro history. This is a tiny people in a faraway place. And what happened to them might not seem so relevant to us today. And yet the themes that they encounter, we still encounter today. We still encounter prejudice, restrictions based on ethnicity, suffering. And yet culture and ethnicity also strengthens people of having your community, of getting support from one another, of knowing that you're not alone, that you're a part of a larger community. All of those things strengthen these people to keep going and to keep going until things got better.
And keep their culture going.
Right, indeed.
Well, we should say what you're doing now in your life.
I work for the Jewish Federation of New Mexico. I'm the director of community outreach, and I'm also the director of Hillel at the University of New Mexico, which is a Jewish student center. Mm-hmm. I'm the editor of the New Mexico Jewish E-Link, the little Jewish newspaper, which is now found online.
Oh. And we can't not say, for people who remember your father.
Thank you. and my father died in 1999, and he was one of New Mexico's first providers of abortion care.
Louis Coughlin.
Yes.
And I'm sure that there are listeners who remember him well. Because he was quite a character.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I have a little bit of his fire, but nowhere near the extent that he had.
Well, thanks a lot. I've been talking to Sarah Coplick, and we've been talking about her book, A Political and Economic History of the Jews of Afghanistan. It's published, is the name of the publisher Brill?
Brill. It's published by Brill.
Okay, published by Brill. And I guess that's where you can find it. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you so much.